The novel coronavirus continues infecting and killing Illinoisans. And yet, there's growing resistance to the stay-at-home orders and business closures.
A Chicago church opens its doors for in-person Sunday services.
Multnomah County State's attorney publicized that her office will not prosecute businesses or churches for opening up during the stay-at-home order.
We'll have the latest on COVID-19 in Illinois with our Monday Reporters Roundtable. Plus, we've heard the handshake is no more. How will this pandemic change both our personal interactions and society more generally? A conversation about what the new normal could look like. And in newsrooms across the country, obituary desks are expanding as they work to try and celebrate life during this global pandemic. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, more than 68,000 people have tested positive for the coronavirus in Illinois, and at least 2,974 people have died from the disease. That's 2,974 mothers and fathers, grandmothers and grandfathers, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters. How do you commemorate so many lives lost? Later this hour, we'll talk to someone who's doing just that as one of the lead obituary writers at the Chicago Tribune. We'll also look at how our social norms have changed on account of COVID-19 and try to look ahead to which ones might stick after we're on the other side of this pandemic. But first, this morning, Governor J.B. Pritzker's office announced that staff would begin working from home after a member of the administration tested positive for COVID-19. Quote, the asymptomatic staff member tested positive late last week and was in close contact with the governor and other staff members. Unquote. This is the second time a member of the administration has tested positive. The last was in late March and early April. The administration says Pritzker and the other roughly 20 staff members who've been working at the Thompson Center in Chicago all tested negative, but all the same, they'll begin working from home. Meanwhile, critical voices keep pecking at the governor's stay-at-home orders, especially from the opposition political party. Republican congressional challenger Jeannie Ives has a petition encouraging Pritzker to allow youth sports leagues this summer. But even the Illinois Restaurant Association has become a critic. It's notable because it was one of the few business groups to support Pritzker's first major piece of legislation, gradual increases in the minimum wage over the next several years. They say now his phased plan for reopening is not fast enough for the restaurant industry. Joining us to talk about this and more are three reporters who've been covering the pandemic in different parts of Illinois. Jenna Dooley is the news director at Northern Public Radio, WNIJ, in DeKalb and Rockford. Jamie Nesbitt-Golden is a reporter with the news site Block Club Chicago, where she covers the neighborhoods of Englewood, Auburn, Gresham, and Chatham on the south side. And Mary Hansen is a reporter for NPR Illinois, WUIS, in Springfield. Jenna, Jamie, Mary, thanks for being here today. And Mary, I will start with you. That awkward, how do you say hello at the beginning of the radio segment? Mary, I'm going to start with you. What are you seeing in Springfield and the surrounding areas?
Yeah, so in Springfield, you know, for in terms of cases, it's easiest to talk about in terms of the county because that's how they track. So here in Sangamon County, there's 270 confirmed cases and about two dozen deaths. And Springfield and Sangamon County were sort of plugging along, seeing, maybe one or two cases per day up until about mid-April when there was an outbreak at a long-term care facility just north of Springfield in Sherman, the Villas East. At the end of April, the state sent a bunch of test kits in there to test all the staff and all the residents, no matter if they were showing symptoms or not. And we saw a big increase in the number of cases. So just in that facility alone, there are about 104 confirmed cases and 20 deaths of residents, unfortunately. So a big number of the confirmed cases and deaths associated with the county are from just that one facility.
And Jamie, you, as we said a moment ago, you cover a few neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago. What are you seeing there?
A lot of the same, but people in these neighborhoods are worried about not having access to testing. That's like one of the big issues. While several more testing sites have opened on the south and southwest sides, it's still a matter of making the tests more accessible to residents. A lot of these places are drive-through or drive-up facilities. A lot of people don't have cars. So now you have to figure out how to safely test folks who, you know, don't have access to reliable transportation. I'm also seeing a lot of organizations on the ground sort of rally together and try to, you know, help their, you know, help residents themselves. While they're getting some help from the city, most of these organizations are relying on donations and themselves to sort of, you know, keep, you know, their neighbors safe.
Hmm.
A lot of mutual aid work, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to come back to that a little later in our conversation, because I've been reading some of your coverage about, you know, say, a food pantry that got some help from some people at the University of Chicago. We'll come back to that. Jenna, I've seen Rockford, which is in your listening area at WNIJ. I've seen Rockford described as a hotspot for COVID-19. What are you and your members of your news team seeing on the ground there?
Winnebago County has 926 positive cases, and there are those clusters of concern, including the Winnebago County Jail and in longer-term care facilities, like Mary mentioned, and what we're seeing in other areas of the country. There's also a cluster of concern at a residential facility for young adults receiving treatment for mental health and substance disorders. But the term hotspot is polarizing itself. Supporters of economic reopening, they did rally at an intersection in Rockford over the weekend. The Rockford Register Star had a slideshow on their website from the event. And in one, there was a man holding a sign, and he's decrying that term hotspot to characterize the Winnebago County numbers. The sign said 26 deaths out of the total county population of about 300,000 is not a hotspot.
Hmm. You know, I saw a story that caught my attention from Rockford last week about some issue with the testing site there. I gather that some tests, well, the initial story was some tests went missing, the state was called in, and then apparently, I don't know, the lab was like reporting results using carrier pigeons or something. Can you tell me like what happened there?
Well, the plea came from the Winnebago County Board Chairman to the governor. He wrote a letter, a public letter, and it said more than 2,000 tests were missing. Those tests took place at a community-based drive-through testing site operated by the Illinois National Guard. But what happened is that the tests were delayed. They weren't missing. It was a new lab struggling with electronic reporting capabilities. So the state responded back, and now those results are being sent to another lab that does have the capacity to do electronic results much faster. The county health director, Sandra Martell, though, is assuring those who were tested at that site, they have a full manifest of everyone who is tested. They have the full information. But she cautions that the delay, if it took weeks to get these test results, it's a real concern because that hampers those efforts to slow the spread of the virus.
You know, Jamie, you mentioned a moment ago that the testing was also a concern on the south and southwest sides of Chicago. Is it an issue of capacity or the amount of testing sites? What is the big concern there?
The amount of testing sites, really. There were, when the pandemic first started, there weren't really a lot of testing sites on the south side. In the weeks since the shelter in place order, there have been several hospitals, like Roseland, not several hospitals, but Roseland Community Hospital is one testing site that opened. Another one opened in Auburn Gresham, the Christian Community Health Center. But they're still pretty spread out, and it's really hard, again, to get to these places if you don't have a car. I think both of them are drive-through sites. You don't really have any walk-up sites in these areas, which poses a problem.
Hmm. So let's take sort of a step back from what people are seeing on the ground. And Mary, I want to return to you because last week you did some coverage of Governor J.B. Pritzker's five-phase plan to begin allowing certain businesses and activities to resume, and eventually it would reopen schools. Can you give us kind of the sort of summation view? What are some of the highlights of that plan?
Yeah, so it is, as you mentioned, a five-step plan. We're actually in step two, so it's a bit of a sort of retroactive. They're calling step one the stay-at-home order, those sort of strict restrictions that were happening from March through May 1st, and then As of May 1st, we entered phase two, you know, still under the stay-at-home order, but some outdoor activities being allowed now. And then, you know, like golfing and things like that. And then to get from phase two to phase, well, I should say first, the state is being divided up into four regions, sort of Chicago, North Central Illinois, they're calling it, from like the Wisconsin border all the way down to Peoria and Bloomington, Central Illinois, so from Quincy to the border with Indiana, including Champaign-Urbana and Springfield, and then all of Southern Illinois with the Metro East and Carbondale. So those regions have gotten some criticism. Some of the Republicans say those regions are far too big and, you know, don't take into account sort of some of the more localized things that are happening. But back to the phases, we're in phase two, as I mentioned, and to get to phase three and phase four, there's sort of similar requirements. We have to have, a region has to have 14 days of a stable positivity rate in terms of tests, and that has to be below 20% or declining, and then 28 days of stable hospital admissions, as well as more robust testing and tracing. And the 28 days is another thing that's sort of drawn some criticism, you know, from different people saying, you know, other states are looking at just the 14 days in between, you know, moving from phase to phase, because that's the what's thought to be the incubation period for the disease. So we're looking at moving to phase three, which would open more offices, more retail, and then potentially onto phase four might maybe come at the end of June for some of these regions, which would be, you know, restaurants opening and schools, and then finally onto phase five, which would be the, you know, sort of more back to normal. But to get from phase four to phase five, the governor has said what we need is either a vaccine or an effective treatment. So that could be a long way off.
Yeah, and we're kind of just a few minutes left in our segment today, but Mary, getting to phase four, I understand, is where the restaurants can reopen, right? And that particular thing, and as you said, 28 days, that could be a couple of months off before we could get to that point. And there's been some pushback from the Restaurant Association?
Yeah, so the Restaurant Association is pushing to have restaurants be able to open in phase three. So that would be, you know, potentially at the end of May for some of these regions if they meet those benchmarks, instead of phase four, which wouldn't be until the end of June at the earliest. And they're saying, you know, we work with public health departments all the time to meet food regulations or, you know, food safety regulations. We're all trained in this sort of stuff, and we believe that our industry can handle these additional regulations and then make it a safe environment for people to go out to eat again. And, you know, they also employ a lot of people across the state. The governor was asked about this on Friday, and he said, you know, from the public health officials and the epidemiologists that he's talked to, restaurants are a little bit more difficult than, say, an office or another place to make it safe and to sort of stop the spread in that environment. So he's holding firm at the moment.
Jamie, in Chicago, do you get the sense in talking to people that they're itching to get out and about, to go to restaurants or go back to work, that sort of thing?
They want to, but they're also very, very wary of it. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they're willing to stick it out for as long as they're supposed to. And even after, you know, we get the green light, I'm not really sure if people are going to be rushing back to these places. But there is a restlessness. There's also anxiety about, you know, what lies ahead, I believe. But I do see a lot of people not really adhering to the mask requirement, which is a little scary.
Yeah, interesting.
But, you know, you have folks who feel as though that, you know, that this virus won't hurt them, so they feel comfortable to go out without any protective gear.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there has been this coverage of this disconnect in Chicago between the government officials and the media, you know, giving this guidance on the one hand, and particularly some younger members of the African American community on the other. And we actually had a conversation about this on the show last week. And I wonder, are you seeing evidence of that divide or that the city is doing something to meet people where they are?
Yeah, I definitely am seeing the divide. I think we have a tendency to sort of, as adults, condescend to youth, particularly Black youth. There's a lot of pull up your pants, do right, you know, be better. But if you aren't given hope, and if you're constantly told that you're a screw up, you're going to sort of not care about what happens. There's this sort of a nihilistic POV that these kids have because no one's talking to them, they're talking at them. That said, I think Lori Lightfoot getting on Zoom with Jamal Green last weekend was definitely a step in the right direction, sort of talking to these kids, hearing them out. As a matter of fact, Jamal Green has a whole 5-day virtual series sort of planned to, you know, sort of that's aimed at, you know, Chicago kids and young adults to sort of get them involved in the conversation because they haven't really been a part of it. So I do think that, you know, her taking the time out to join that discussion is great. I think that she was willing to hear the criticism about approaching the kids on the street and sort of, you know, admonishing them. I think she took that advice to heart, and I think changing their approach and how we talk to these kids will make the difference in the long run.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid that is all the time we have for this segment. I'm sorry, there's so much more we wanted to talk about. We will have links to all the coverage that you and your colleagues have been doing. The interesting story about University of Chicago volunteers staffing a food bank is on Block Club Chicago, the food bank that was on the brink of closure. And Jenna, I know one of your colleagues has been doing work on how homeless shelters are trying to reach people who can't abide by the governor's stay-at-home orders. We'll have links to all that on our website and our Twitter page, 21stshow, 21stshow.org. I want to thank Jenna Dooley of Northern Public Radio, Jamie Nesbitt-Golden from Block Club Chicago, and Mary Hansen from NPR Illinois. Thank you all so much for being with me this morning.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation on changing social norms during the pandemic. Is the handshake gone for good? Stay with us. More to come in just a moment. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many things we once considered normal before the coronavirus pandemic could disappear in a post-pandemic world, whenever that might be. Last month, Dr. Anthony Fauci said this about the handshake, for example.
You don't ever shake anybody's hands. That's clear.
So in addition to more regular hand washing and the possible end of the handshake, we wanted to take a look on today's show at some of the other ways society might look different in the coming years, at both the individual level and when it comes to public life in general, on account of the coronavirus. To talk more about this, we're joined by Richard Sullivan, an associate professor of sociology at Illinois State University, and Suzanne Degas-White, chair and professor of counseling and counselor education at Northern Illinois University. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Professor Sullivan, I want to start with you. Dr. Fauci mentioned that the handshake could be no more. Do you think that the handshake could end with our generation?
I think not. I think that the handshake has got a long, long history, and it survived other pandemics historically, and it is just so ingrained. I mean, I find myself even having to fight it now. We're early on in that, but I mean, if this goes on for years, maybe, but I think if it's, you know, 12 to 18 months, I don't think it will be enough to extinguish the handshake. We'll have alternate forms of greetings, I suppose, in the interim, but I think it'll be around. It'll come back.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a short-term change, perhaps, but there might be some other long-term changes from this, and things, you know, will go back gradually, perhaps. And I wonder, what are some of the other social norms you see changing in the long-term, Professor Sullivan?
Well, some of the things I've been thinking about here as I'm observing this is that I think there may be more of a recognition of our shared interdependence, I guess, that's how I'd put it, the way that we are we rely on other people that we might not even know. I think that's becoming abundantly clear. We didn't really think about grocery store workers, for example, as being essential workers. Today we do. Truck drivers, likewise. These are, you know, segments of the population that don't really get a lot of prestige or status. And all of a sudden they're being elevated and asked to do some of our heavy lifting. I think that's, I'm hoping that will be one of the things that we see going forward. It's not just the people at the very top of the status pyramid, the people in charge that are getting the kudos and the recognition. I think it'll be a lot of these people in day-to-day jobs that we're seeing now are much more important than we realized.
Yeah. And Professor Degas-White, I wonder, what are some of the social norms that you envision changing in the months and years after the pandemic?
Well, I think part of what we're going to see, I appreciate the idea of the interdependence, and I think the recognition that essential jobs, who really is essential, I think we're revaluing that. And I think that we're also beginning to realize that as we move through life, we need that human connection every bit as much as we always have. But we realize, too, that we've got to be mindful of the ways in which our public health affects personal health. And what are the choices we're making that may influence the well-being of other people? So I think that interdependence, that connection to others, is actually growing stronger, because most of us, we exist in a society that is pretty much individualistic, that we really prize individual achievement. But I think the majority of adults now have realized that by ourselves, we're not going to thrive. And I think the kids today are also going to grow up and be changed by what they're seeing now, by what they're experiencing, and realizing also kind of the ways in which nothing in this world really is as guaranteed as we hope it can be, but that people come together to support one another. I think that's really going to be a strong lesson that, if we're wise, we'll take with us, that we've all come together to help ensure the well-being of the least among us.
Interesting.
I think it's changing our own views. I think it could be, like I said, from an individual society, we're not exactly as communal as many other nations might be. But I think this communal bent may be something, if we're lucky, that would stay with us here in the United States.
So I hear from both of you this idea of interdependence, maybe, and community, and sort of re-looking at community. And I wonder, from a big picture standpoint, Professor Sullivan, I'll turn back to you, on a societal or governmental level, is there anything else you're following as a sociologist?
Yeah, this is a good time to be a sociologist. that we are in this state of flux. And one of the things that I was able to impart on the students as we moved to online instruction at the end of this term, was that, you know, we often don't see these things that are happening, or that happen every day, that we take for granted until we have these moments of crisis. And now we can't take anything for granted. And I think governmentally, socially, I think we're going to see this, a recognition that, for one thing, I don't think we've had this sort of fixation on markets and the individual actions and individual firms being the sort of the driver of the society and the economy. I think we're going to see, we're going to see a return to this idea that markets by themselves are not going to solve some of these problems. They can't deliver healthcare in times of crisis like this. There are two different and competing models. And so, like we had in the Great Depression, coming out of the Great Depression, we had a realization that government played a role in maintaining a social safety net. And that, over the last 70, 80 years, that has evaporated. We've kind of gone away from the idea that we are all in this together, and that we can rely on the government, our shared sort of collective body that protects the least among us. We've gone away from that. And I think we're gonna see a reaffirmation of the collective effort, the need to look out for each other, and that if somebody doesn't have health care coverage and they're working some minimum wage job at a sandwich factory or a sandwich shop, their health could affect me if they don't have paid sick time, for example, or access to health care.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're talking about changing social norms and what is temporary, what might be permanent, and as well as just bigger, broader changes we might see in society. We're talking with Richard Sullivan, a professor of sociology at Illinois State University, and Suzanne Deggs-White, who is chair and professor of counseling and counselor education at Northern Illinois University. And as a reminder, you can always join the conversation. If you have a vision of what the new normal might be or what might change in the coming years, give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. So we've been talking about the bigger changes. What about our personal relationships? We've only been allowed to interact with a very small number of people in person, those in our household. I wonder, Professor Deggs-White, do you have an idea of whether people may find friendships harder or that friendships could end after the pandemic?
Well, this experience has been unique for all of us to realize that how much we value social interaction. Or for the introverts among us, how nice it's been not to have to interact face-to-face, but to be able to interact through social gatherings via online video calls, through cell phone, FaceTime, whatever it might be. But what I've realized talking to people and people who have come from both ends of the extrovert-introvert spectrum is the fact that they all can't wait to get back into the regular routine of social connections. They realize that we want to be with our friends, but they also have some concerns that we want to make sure our friends are making safe choices and that we also have to respect some of our friends may be a lot more anxiety prone than others as we go back and try to figure out what life is going to be like as lockdowns begin to ease. And I think it's that human perception of fear, human perception of threat, and that really does vary based on personality. And we're not going to be able to hold others. We should assume everyone's coming from a space of where they have to take care of themselves. And so we've got to be aware that some of our friends may be more ready to get together, even social distancing out in a park, than others, and to take and not to have expectations for how others are going to respond. Because each of us are very much shaped by our own upbringing, by our own level of health. And if we're dealing with some of those underlying conditions that may be less visible to other people, we may come out with a lot more caution and fear of being within 12 feet of friends or being face-to-face in a closed space. And we've got to recognize that we can't let other people's fears hinder the connection and the relationship we have. And with introverts, some of them may want to stay relying a lot on video get-togethers and playing video games together, watch parties, whatever it might be, and that our individual personalities are going to influence how we come out of this. And we've got to recognize like the individual variations in our friends and support one another. And I think this is what this is about, is recognizing that some people may seem a little more anxious, and that's okay, because maybe they've experienced something that another person hasn't. Maybe they lost someone or they've been ill themselves and they don't want to jump back in and risk their own health in order to make someone else feel better about themselves.
Yeah, I'm guessing. These conversations could be a little difficult and awkward to have, right? I know myself, I'm trying to picture sitting in my favorite restaurant, even if, you know, the booth next to us was empty and somebody was 6 feet over, that's going to make me pretty nervous to be in that situation.
Yeah. And other friends will be ready. I've got friends who live throughout Illinois, and some of them are, you know, going for walks with neighbors a few doors down that they haven't seen in 6 weeks. They said, "We miss being together. We're outside, we're walking. I said, are you wearing masks?" They say, "No." And I went, this spot, you know, like we're all going to have what we think is safe and not safe. And we've got to make sure that however we're interacting in the world, that we're interacting in a way that makes us feel safe with our own choices. Because I think this, while we realize the total interconnection of all of us, and we're realizing, you know, there used to be saying the political, it still is a saying, the political is personal. Well, the public health is personal health. And so we've got to recognize, while I can't force another person to make choices I think are better for their health, I also don't have to risk exposing myself to another person's poor choices. A lot of people liken it to the no smoking areas. And it really is, you know, you've got the right to smoke, but you don't have the right to make me breathe secondhand smoke. You've got the right not to wear a mask, but you don't have the right to make me be within 6 feet of you or in your company if you choose not to wear a mask.
Yes, I would definitely like to sit in the no COVID section of the restaurant.
I would like, you know, wouldn't that be wonderful? We kind of joke about, you know, when I'm on video calls and things with colleagues or with people who've been diagnosed and have recovered from COVID, we kind of call it the COVID. Like, I don't want to get a case of the COVID. And what we're trying to do is minimize the fear we have, because I think the uncertainty about how each individual case of COVID goes makes us all fearful. So, you know, well, I know someone, you know, they're fine. They were sick a week and got up. You know other people that didn't live through this illness. And so I think it's the not knowing that really contributes to our anxiety. Our society, most of us do believe that 2 + 2 = 4, and we believe that gravity keeps the planets and the galaxy where everything needs to be. So we do have a tendency to assume logic and reason, and that there's a reason things happen and you can predict outcomes. But when it comes to COVID-19, none of us can predict what the outcome is going to be for any particular patient. Right. And that lack of certainty throws all of us off balance.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with Suzanne Deggs-White, Chair and Professor of Counseling at Northern Illinois University, and also Richard Sullivan, Professor of Sociology at Illinois State. You're welcome to join the conversation, 800-222-9455. Professor Sullivan, I want to take sort of a step back in our last few minutes of our conversation here. Are there examples from history we can draw on that might provide some perspective on how our society might change? I mean, you mentioned the New Deal era in the past. I think those of us who have parents or grandparents who lived through the Depression, you know that there was a certain frugality instilled in that generation. Do you see changes like that coming to people who are, you know, our age and younger now?
Yeah, I think this is a seminal moment for this generation. And a lot of this, you know, again, a lot of my students who are just coming of age right in this moment, it's like the world that they thought they were going to enter into, you know, in terms of work and careers and family life, that's called into question now. There's a lot of uncertainty. Yes, I think that the level of frugality, you mentioned this, it's like, even in the few weeks, it's really not that been in the big scope of things. It hasn't been that long that we've been sheltering in place. We are learning new things. We're learning how to cut our own hair, for example. That's one of the things. So our own masks. I mean, I just had an experience. One of the masks that we were using in my family broke, and so I had to learn how to use a needle and thread. I think this is a new sort of era that we're going to enter into, and depending on how it plays out, will we have scarcity of certain commodities and services? We don't know. You know, there's going to be a real shakeup in the restaurant business, and how do we cook at home? We're cooking way more at home now, and we're relying less on delivery. We have all kinds of different ways that we're relying on ourselves more. In my neighborhood, people are planting gardens that never had gardens before. These are the sorts of things that we'll see. Whether or not that will, you know, persist, I think a lot of it depends on whether or not, you know, how long the pandemic itself and the sort of crisis moment of the pandemic lasts.
Just real briefly, in about 30 seconds, Professor Sullivan, I think if you look at the chart of deaths from the first half of the 20th century, I've heard Bill Gates talk about this. There's obvious spike of World War I and World War II, and then the Spanish flu in between. But until a few months ago, I would guess a lot of people didn't know about the Spanish flu, and it didn't really make it into the mass culture. I've heard Hemingway and Faulkner never wrote about it. And again, in about 15, 20 seconds, Professor Sullivan, do you see this pandemic leaving a mark in our culture?
Yes, I'm not an expert on the Spanish flu era, but I think that the impact that this is having on both economically and politically, we're in the midst of a presidential election year, and we're seeing the pandemic and the virus itself being politicized. Mm-hmm. And we have people, you know, the norms, you talked about the norms, people are, you know, the mask now becomes a political symbol. I think that's going to be harder to sweep this under the rug. And we're just beginning to see the devastation economically on people's lives. I think it's going to be tough.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Richard Sullivan, professor of sociology at Illinois State, and Suzanne Dengus-White, chair and professor of counseling at Northern Illinois University. Thanks for being here, and more to come on the 21st in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the coronavirus continues to claim lives here in Illinois and across the country, newsrooms have expanded obituary desks in an effort to document and celebrate life during this global pandemic. A few weeks ago, the Chicago Tribune had four reporters and a single editor working on obituaries. Now that number is closer to 20. Sophie Sherry has been writing obituaries for the Chicago Tribune, and she joins us now via Zoom for more. Sophie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I understand you actually started as an intern and you've stayed on to help write obituaries. What has the past couple of months been like for you and your team?
Yeah, so I started as an intern at the Chicago Tribune this January. And that internship was supposed to end in April, but I have hung around to assist with COVID-19 coverage and largely assist with these obituaries. So when the state was nearing the stay-at-home order, the newsroom sort of divided up into COVID-19 related teams, pulling reporters from every corner. So we have sports reporters, features reporters, business reporters, all aiding in this effort. And as you said, the obituary team was just one of those teams that began with about five people and one editor. And as the number of deaths has continued to grow, that team has grown as well. So now we have close to 20 reporters who are taking on these tasks each week. I've sort of been with the effort for a couple of weeks now, close to a month probably. And I think looking at my own personal spreadsheet, there's about 50 individuals that I'm personally sort of efforting, trying to reach out to, or in the midst of writing myself.
Wow.
So that's kind of what things have looked like for me so far.
And I've noticed in some of the bylines on these stories, these obituaries, and some of them are sort of capsules, a little mm-hmm. shorter or briefs, I guess they're called in the newspaper industry. but I've seen the names of like Chris Jones, the theater critic. I mean, this is kind of mm-hmm. an all hands on deck effort, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, like one of the first obit reporters, I think, was our college basketball and football reporter was one of the first to immediately chip in with the effort. So yeah, it's really been pulling from all corners of the newsroom. And a lot of those reporters, like the theater critic you mentioned, are doing this work on top of their traditional beats and staying on top of that coverage as well.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit about how this process works. I understand you get mm-hmm. information from the medical examiner every day. What happens after that?
Yeah, so we get sort of the different names of those lives lost to COVID-19 sent to us from the medical examiner's office every day. And then our editor in charge of the obit team, Jeff Cohen, as well as the reporters sort of been taking the lead on this, Christy Grotowski, they take those names that were given from medical examiners and basically just assign those out each every other day. The reporters on the obit teams, or every 2 days or so, we get sent a spreadsheet where we're basically assigned eight new individuals to reach out to. So we're probably a couple days behind the actual those names coming in from medical examiner's office, but we get those names and then immediately start trying to find family members to reach out to. So when I get sent that spreadsheet every other day, I then sort of do an initial Google search to try to see if there's been any other coverage of that individual, especially with stories about police officers, fire, first responders. A lot of times those will be publicized already and we'll have a point of contact. And other times I just turn to social media and I'm searching names, trying to find family members and then reaching out to those individuals. And we try to do that as soon as possible. and obviously give that family member as much time as they need to decide if they want to speak with us and participate in this. And so after that, I interview that family member over the phone. You know, unfortunately, we can't meet face to face like this. And unfortunately, given the circumstances, a lot of the family members I speak to are currently themselves quarantining, just because they or their family member have recently been around an individual who had the virus. So speaking to those family members and then working to write up some sort of life story. And I always tell them when I'm reaching out, you know, we don't want to focus on how this individual died, but sit down and talk about how they lived. And that's sort of the focus of these stories for us. So yeah, it's, I obviously try to do as many interviews as I can in a given day or week, even though it can be incredibly challenging. And each one of these interviews hits hard, and I hang up the phone every time thinking, this can't possibly get any worse. And then you hear a story that's just even more haunting than the first. But yeah, we work to get those up on our website, on the page dedicated to these stories as soon as possible. And then we're also working to get every single one of those in print as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're speaking with Sophie Sherry, who's working on the obituary team at the Chicago Tribune, trying to document some of the lives that have been lost to the coronavirus here in Illinois in the last couple of months. Do you find that you have to sort of sell this idea to families? Are most people receptive to it, or do you have to do some convincing?
I think for the most part, a lot of families are willing once they understand that, you know, we're not reaching out to get the details of, we don't need all the details of what happened in the hospital, what happened with this diagnosis. You know, we really want to focus on telling the story of their lives, the things they cared about, their family. And I think once families understand that it's going to be about that, that we're not going to be asking them to necessarily rehash the trauma of the past week, and instead hopefully this can be some sort of healing, a means of healing almost, a chance to kind of talk about the life that individual lived before this virus. I've found that a lot of people are really receptive, and obviously we've run into family members who, you know, aren't ready to talk about this yet. There's certain families that don't necessarily want it publicized that their relative died from this virus and therefore don't want to participate. And others who just, again, are still coming to terms with how they would want to share this story. But I think for the most part, people have been pretty receptive to the idea. And even though conversations begin pretty difficult at times, when I initially pick up the phone at the end, I think a lot of family members feel happy and feel better that they had the chance to, you know, share a little bit about that individual with someone else. So yeah, I mean, again, all the conversations start out a little challenging, but end always kind of on a positive note as they're given a chance to reflect and kind of share with me the lives of their family member.
Yeah. So you mentioned you've done dozens of these stories at this point. Which ones stick out to you? Can you share a couple of those stories that have stuck with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So personally, of the ones that I wrote, some of the ones that have stuck out to me the most are some of the younger people that I've written about. And I think at first everyone sort of thought that people under the age of 50 would be kind of spared from this virus, and we quickly learned that wasn't the case. And so I've personally written about a couple of 30-year-olds, and obviously there's been some instances of younger individuals, but I've seen a good amount of 30-year-olds, and those have been some of the hardest for me. I think I spoke to a widow or a fiance.
Sophie, are you there? We seem to have had a technical problem with our connection. While we are trying to reestablish our contact with Sophie Sherry, we've been discussing, she is a member of the Chicago Tribune obituary team, and we've been talking about what that has been like in the COVID-19 pandemic. While we are attempting to reestablish that connection, I'll say as a reminder, if you ever want to share what you think about what we've been talking about, we would love to hear it. Send me an email at talk@21stshow.org. That address, again, is talk@21stshow.org. You can also, of course, always tweet us on our website at 21stshow. That's at 21st show. I think we are still working on reestablishing that connection, so we're going to take a brief pause right now. Okay, we're back. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are continuing our conversation with Sophie Sherry. She's on the obituary team at the Chicago Tribune. So, Sophie, you were just about to share with us the story of, I think it was not a widow, but a woman whose fiance had died, a mother. Can you talk a little bit about
Sorry about that. So, one of the stories I worked on was speaking with the now widow of a young 32-year-old man, and they had a 4-year-old child together. And I think those stories, those interviews are obviously really hard to conduct because, I mean, every story is tragic, but especially with someone as young as 30, she didn't really see this coming. Everything she heard up to this point was that younger individuals would kind of overcome this. You just kind of leave those interviews sort of awestruck. It doesn't really make sense to you, why this young man. That particular story of the widow I spoke to, who will now be a single mother to their 4-year-old child, that her husband entered the hospital and it seemed that he was on the road to recovery. And then one morning she got a call from doctors that while they were repositioning him, his ventilator fell out and he began to crash and ultimately did not ever come back. And so things like that, you just obviously don't make sense. And it's especially with these younger stories, a lot of instances where it seems like things are getting better and then suddenly they're not. And those have been really challenging to report on. And I think, on top of the young people, some of the other really difficult stories, and I know Christy Gertowski has done a lot of these, as well as other reporters, are the stories of those frontline medical workers that we've lost. I think in the state, as of last week, there were at least 25 medical professionals who had passed due to COVID-19 related causes. And these people are truly making the ultimate sacrifice. And it's really hard to hear those stories of nurses who are pulling extra shifts and ultimately contracting the virus, or published one story of a surgical tech who was just days away from retirement and he contracted the virus and unfortunately didn't survive. Have been some of the ones that have stuck with me.
We've only got about a minute left, and I wonder if you have, you've written so many obituaries, are you seeing common threads? Every life is different, obviously, but is there something that everybody's going through that's sort of the same?
Young or old, every single person I've spoken to has sort of left me with, I wish I could have been there, or I wish that my relative didn't have to die alone. Due to the nature of this virus, there's so many restrictions on who can be in hospital rooms. And so basically everyone I've spoken to is struggling with the fact that their loved one, that they couldn't be there with them during their passing. And unfortunately, a lot of them as well are now forced to mourn alone. That widow that I just spoke of, she's been in quarantine since her husband's passing with their child and hasn't been able to be around family, hug family members, get assistance from those family members as you traditionally would after a loss. A lot of people haven't been able to have a funeral in the way that they would like, or are told if they're going to enter a funeral home, they all need to be 6 feet apart and wearing masks and can't hug one another while they're in that space. So I think the common thread I've seen is just, I mean, the real tragedy, and that people who haven't been personally impacted yet don't realize, is that these individuals are in the hospital room alone and without their family members up to those last moments.
Well, Sophie Sherry, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for doing the work you're doing. It's important work.
Thank you so much.
Sophie Sherry is a member of the obituary team at the Chicago Tribune. And that is all the time we have for the 21st today. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey, with technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.